Hello, this is Corinne Motokaitis, and welcome to How She Really Does It. You are tuned to KDRT, LP, in Davis, California, 101.5 FM. If you enjoy community-run KDRT LP, you'll want to know that we face a big threat to our existence. A commercial station also operating at 101.5 is moving to Woodland from Gridley. This move-in from 80 kilometers away to less than 4 will literally knock us off the air. If you'd like to help, please go to kdirt.org, kdrt.org, or call 757-2419. This morning on How She Really Does It, I've always been interested in human interest stories or other people's stories and journeys, especially other women, and I have wondered in bewilderment how she really does it. Through the years, I've sought out mentors and resources, and now I'm sharing them with you. This talk show is meant to inspire, empower, and entertain and be a resource for women. Each week, there is a different topic focusing on what women face in their day-to-day life. This show provides an opportunity for women to learn from each other and learn how she really does it. Do you ever wonder how others balance family, work, volunteering, marriage, self, friends, financial issues, our children in sports, parenting in school, religion and family, career and family, health? You can email me at howshe@gmail.com. This morning, we have two UC Davis professors here. One professor was a former chair of the Environmental Studies and Civil Engineering's Deb Niemeyer. And then we have the UCD professor of geology, Isabel Montanez. And they're here to discuss women in science. Ladies, thanks for coming this morning. And so what are the obstacles that women face in this male-dominated area?
That's a tough one. By definition, the last couple of decades have seen women trying to break into, perhaps most importantly, a network. I don't know that it's exclusively because women don't make networks and men do. I think women do make networks, but there were no existing networks for women. So certainly I think Deb can speak for herself. I'm sure she would agree that all of us who came through the system a couple of decades ago and until very recently just found that these networks are very strong and they're impossible to break into for various reasons. I think women are starting to develop their own networks, the next generation and our generation, but you can imagine all the things that fall out of not having that network, whereas the men do.
Well, the time period that I think that in the last, 30-some years, a lot of stuff has changed for women. You know, women can now do their own finances. They can get a loan themselves, where before 1975, women couldn't do that. So a lot of things have been changing, but sometimes, you know, we still are looking for more progress, I think.
Yeah, well, it's comfort zone to some degree. I mean, if you're going into male-dominated fields, whether you're a student or a colleague, there's a comfort thing. I mean, these men, that's where they find their comfort. They can go home to have the gender issues that they might not be as comfortable with. It's the way we've been raised in society. So I think a lot of attitudes, probably subconscious, are, look, I have my network. Why should I be put out if a woman makes me feel nervous or uncomfortable or intimidating? Or I don't know how to – I can't say the things I would say with my colleagues, or I can't act the way I would act normally if she's a part of this network. And who knows if there isn't sexual tension there as well. I'm sure there is. And
it's kind of like there was this comfort area of, well, we were able to play and we were able to play and within our rules, but now you bring in another gender, and that kind of is disruptive.
That's right.
And not many people like change to begin with, so that makes sense.
I think, too, you know, I'd throw this in that women come in, the numbers are so few, especially in engineering and in a lot of the sciences, that they come in to higher expectations. We don't have a bell curve. You know, the average woman is generally operating at a much higher level than, say, the average guy. And it's just because there's so few, so the expectations are so much greater, the expectations of yourself and the expectations of the community you're operating in. So, you know, without that bell curve where you can distinguish normal from, you know, really outstanding to not as high performing, you know, everybody, most women I know are operating at the far end of the curve right now. You know, there's just not enough women. So expectations are much bigger.
So the expectations are bigger because there's only a few women, and so the women just feel that they have more pressure to perform?
I think they feel more pressure to perform, and I think that society and the communities they're operating in, it takes more to be evaluated positively. Women have to do more, and the research substantiates this, that women will generally perform at a higher level for a peer evaluation that would be more or less for an average guy. So, you know, so you come into this whole mechanism of just higher expectations, and you have to succeed at a much higher level.
And is that because you have to, there's like stereotypes that you have to break through.
Right.
So to prove that those are not true, you're going to go to another end of the spectrum where the men don't have those stereotypes that are already right there in their stumbling blocks.
Right. Well, I think it's how we define ego as well. I don't think most of us are born entitled to a certain level of ego as girls. We struggle with how we define that. You know, what's good enough? What is we're defining our own expectations of ourselves, I think. And I think guys are entitled to a certain degree of ego when they grow up. And they don't question as much whether it's good enough and whether they've achieved enough.
Right, right.
I think that drives a lot of us. So, you know, it makes for big differences.
Well, and do you find a difference, like, with a woman, how aggressive she can be versus a man, or how a woman is looked at as being aggressive when in the same footsteps the man's doing something, but it's not considered aggressive?
Absolutely. I mean, Deb, you want to comment on that?
No, I think that's certainly true, and there's research, again, that bears this out, that, you know, women who are acting assertively are often viewed as acting aggressively relative to a male act. You know, operating on the same sort of principles.
So how would a woman be able to be effective? And at times you do need to be aggressive or to be assertive and not come across as being aggressive.
I think, you know, for me, I think it's just being very direct about what you're willing to speak out on, to be very direct about what it is that bothers you. And, you know, I've sort of operated how to say this? I've sort of operated on the principle of not cornering people, and especially, you know, cornering men in a field that's, you know, largely composed of men, you know, to not be so assertive that I corner somebody to give them an out, a way to save face. And I think that helps sort of blunt, you know, somebody who's really pushing or ambitious, who's a female.
All right, boy, there you go. That's exactly sort of this issue of the gender difference. I mean, as women, we've discovered that we have to give men a way to bow out gracefully. But I've never experienced – I don't think I've ever can think of a time where I felt that it's been a reversed role where they've given me a chance to bow out gracefully.
Do men spend as much time thinking about how to play this? Because it seems like there's a lot of – thought and effort about how do I go into this situation so that I don't offend anybody but get what I need to get done?
I doubt they give it a second thought. I think we jokingly, between us and friends, joke about how simple life can be for them because they don't spend that time worrying about all those things. And, you know, and to their credit, I mean, I think that, you know, they can perhaps at times think more linearly, and I don't necessarily say it's better, but it's different. We tend to think, you know, in all sorts of nonlinear fashions, and that makes us maybe better in some cases, but it's different. So no, I think
things are slowly changing. I think that there's a generation of men being hired at universities now in faculty positions who have working spouses who tend to be also university professors. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this balancing of life and home and career and ambition and all those sorts of ingredients it is a slow change, and society is changing probably somewhat quicker than the university, but the universities are changing because they're having to.
Mm-hmm. Well, know? there's been an onslaught of new hires, you know, recently. So you are seeing just all the professors changing. It's amazing how much younger they are.
Right. And I have a lot of male colleagues who have working spouses, you know, and they're university professors, they're physicians, they're, you know, there's the whole range of professional employment in there, and they're working just as hard as their, you know, partner. So,
okay. Now, what's the ratio of women to men in science professions, or what? It's a lot. It's Because we know that there's more women now graduating with science degrees than there ever have been, correct?
Yeah, it right. depends on which fields you talk about. So,
I mean, physics, for instance, still right. is appallingly low.
And okay. chemistry is yeah. pretty low.
But it's certainly getting higher in almost every one of the disciplines relative to 10 years ago and 20 years ago.
Well, except for engineering. Engineering's flat right now.
Is it really?
Yeah, so engineering started – these numbers are not quite right, but they're in the ballpark. Started somewhere 16 to 18% 10, 15 years ago and then climbed – or started about 10%, climbed to 16, 18% about 10 years ago, and then have just leveled off and slightly declined over the last few years. And I think, yeah. you know, but I think math and physics and chemistry, certainly biology is like 50% mm-hmm. right now.
And we're seeing it change in the student population, right. undergraduate, graduate, it's across the country, it's 40, 45%, I think, maybe even 50%. But the big difference is that that's not translated to the professional levels.
Right. I think at the full professor level in engineering, it's about 6%.
Wow.
I would yeah. guess it's about equal it's, 10, less than 10% for certain in geology.
Yeah.
And why do you think those factors contribute? Why aren't
– Well, you know, there's a lot of theories about what's happening. There's the leaky pipeline theory where you lose people as you come out of graduate school. And if – you know, they do their master's, don't continue on for their PhD, or there's a theory and probably all of this contributes, right? So at the undergraduate level, a bunch of women don't go on for graduate degrees. Then at the master's level, they decide not to go on for a PhD. And at the PhD level, they finish – and they decide to go to industry as opposed to academics. And so there's a whole set of theories about where the pipeline's leaking, you know, along the way to the academic position. And then you lose probably some before tenure will leave and go to industry mm-hmm. because the climate isn't good or the work-life balance is hard or
so is in industry in science fields is there less of this gender, less of the gender issues going on in industry versus in academics where it's just slower to make change?
Oh, it's funny. I would say it absolutely not. And, my N number, my experience is really limited. It's not based on any studies by any means. But like in the petroleum industry right now, I always chuckle when I hear these issues of mm-hmm. sort of balancing academic life and your own life. And I know it's challenging. Mostly because academic life is not defined. Nobody tells you right. your expectations. But the ironic thing is, Deb and I wouldn't probably be sitting here if we were in industry, because we would have a boss, and that boss would probably be a male boss, and we would have kept hours, and everybody would be watching us. And the next time the pink slips come around with the next layoffs, it would be those who played the game the best, those who showed the boss what he wanted to hear, and or the product he wanted to have, and. I actually – what I can see of the petroleum industry where it's dominantly geologists and geophysicists and petroleum engineers, it's very – I think the gender issues are far stricter there or higher because, you know, you've got this hierarchy and you have years of society dictating behavior. You know, you really have a supervisor who can tell you and make you jump through hoops and judge you. So, yeah, I don't think it's better.
Okay. Now, why do you think there are more men in science than in women in professions?
In academics?
Yeah, in academics.
But it's true by even research,
well,
too, right?
Well, that's true. Yeah. It's a funny thing. I'm just coming back from a weekend in Houston, and there were these stories about women interviewing for faculty positions at various universities. There were many universities represented at this retreat. And one woman told a story about how they were interviewing a top candidate that was being recruited, female, was being recruited from all over the country. And they really, really wanted her, and they were working hard to convince her to come to this particular university. And so they were very careful about how they arranged her interviews and who they had her talk to and, you know, all sorts of things like that. And they took her to the office of a quote-unquote good guy, meaning that he was generally very supportive of women. And she apparently walked into his office and he pulled out some paper and he said to her, okay, I want you to derive some formulas. And And she got very upset and walked out. You know, she's done her PhD. She doesn't have to derive formulas to prove herself, right? Uh-huh. And so she walks out, and of course she's never going to go to that university. And afterwards they, you know, they were talking to him, and there was a perception that somehow women were less proficient at sort of this, you know, at sort of the mathematics, the mechanics of it. And, you know, so he didn't see it wasn't clear there was a gender slight in his own mind, except for that there was this other aspect floating around there. But, you know, you do enough of that and people don't want to go to academics. You know, they'd rather be in a workplace where you prove yourself by your product, right. You know, rather than jumping hurdles to get in. You know, mm-hmm. it's, you know, there's a big hurdle at tenure. If you haven't done it, you're not going to get tenure. You know, you don't need all the other little hurdles along the way.
Right, but we have an illustrious Harvard ex-president who told us it was that way.
Yeah, right.
That was going to be my next topic.
That's right.
This morning we're talking with UCD professors Isabel Montanez and Deb Niemeyer, and we're talking about women in science today on How She Really Does It on KDIRT. LP 101.5 FM. Yeah, speaking of the former president, I was so surprised when I'd heard that Lawrence Summers had voiced that women all over are overall are handicapped as scientists because as a group, they are somehow innately deficient in mathematics. And he said this just recently. It was in the last 2 or 3 years.
Right. Well, right. At least he lost his job over it. Right. That's the good part about it. Right. It's not surprising, but on the other, I mean, it is shocking in that. Can you imagine if you substituted women for a racial group? You know, you imagine the American response to that. I mean, so I think it's more a reflection of his. It's out of context to some degree. I mean, he meant it in a slightly different way, but it's still out of a reflection of his ignorance. And I don't think that many people would go about saying that. They might think it. Presumably, he claims that was on the basis of the way we educate women and the societal baggage we give them from very early on. Mm-hmm. You know, I see it in my kids' grade school. It's all subtle, but you know, unless a girl really shows that she'll eat math for lunch, you know, it's just kind of a somewhere in there we forget that we don't give them special attention unless they rise to that occasion and grasp it. And whereas the boys are just to sort of somehow assume they're a little more mechanical, they're a little more quantitative, and that's fostered. So by the time they hit high school, I think, well, I mean, we see it in our undergraduates, you know, students who, girls who will say, or young women, well, I'm not very good in math. I'd really like to major in geology or imagine engineering. And I keep asking them, how do you know you're not good in math? You haven't taken this series yet. Oh, I just know. I get really nervous. I get nervous on exams. But you don't know. Mm-hmm. Take it. All you have to do is make it through it. And chances are they'll make it through it really with you know, stellar, flying colors. But there is this sort of baggage we create in our young women.
And that happens and you know, girls are told, oh, girls just aren't very good at math. Or sometimes it'll even come from a parent.
That's right.
You know, I'm not very good in math. I'm much better in writing, so you therefore will be too.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we do.
And I think those are things we have to be really cautious of. Mm-hmm. So that's rather unfortunate. Well, you both teach. And what are your experiences working with students in addition to that? Like, how are the women and the men's male students, if you want to discuss this?
No, I'm smiling because I was thinking about some of your class this year.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I probably we should talk about mentoring, like, young women who are in graduate school because, in a sense, that's probably more related to perhaps this issue of their falling out of the system, you know, the leaky pipeline or some of the questions you asked about why are there not more women in the profession and who maybe then ultimately rise through the ranks. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some real issues. I mean, mentoring men, male grad students, is pretty straightforward. At least it has been for me. You know, they want – it's kind of predictable what they want out of you and vice versa. And there's very little sharing of the personal aspects because essentially you're not their role model. You are professionally but not beyond that. But women, it's much more complex. You know, you're their role model. You're also – they're probably competing a little bit with you, whether it's consciously or subconscious. And they are torn between seeing your lifestyle and – asking all those questions about how you're balancing and whether they like what they see or don't, as well as the professional aspects of it. And then there's this ego thing. You know, they're very fragile at times because they haven't been encouraged to develop a strong shell, a strong ego. So you see a lot of issues come up at that point. And you can kind of understand how they translate to, I'm not going to go this route. I'm going to take something safer.
Now, when they do ask you about, you know, how do you balance it, is that something that you'd rather they not ask? Or how are you comfortable with that question?
Oh, yeah. I just more don't like often the response. I think sometimes they've certainly have always judged for themselves, and they seem to think that we don't balance, that our lifestyles are not one to envy. I'm not sure I understand why, but I think they don't think we have very balanced lives. But Deb, I don't know what you want to comment on that one.
Well, I was thinking, you know, I've never really had female graduate students who weren't just absolutely fabulous. I mean, maybe it's the difference between sort of when you get to engineering, you know, you get that hard shell by the time you're done as an undergrad. But my female graduate students are just fabulous, and they bring a really important dimension to my research group. But I get the same feedback from them that the work-life balance is not that great, that as they view it. And what I discovered through the years is that I actually play a lot more than they're aware of. And for some reason, they're more aware of how the guys play, or their perception is that the men don't have a better balance. And in fact, you know, I'm not sure why we do that, why their perception of us is that we're not playing. And so now, last couple of years, I've made it a really big point to sort of announce to my research group when I'm playing, and not to sort of reinforce this picture that all I do is work, because it's not, and it never has been. But somehow, and I know lots of women whose graduate students have that perception of them, and yet, you know, I know for a fact they're play, you know. And so so maybe it's expectations the women graduate students bring themselves when they're viewing you, and they don't take time to sort of evaluate their own perception of what you're doing, you know. So
And I remember just being in college and being a student, or being in my going to graduate school, and you just think that you guys are so high up there. And so it's like, oh, they're such accomplished people. They must be doing, you know, just amazing amount of work. And, you know, the kind of the whole American dream is you work hard and you work hard and you work hard. And that play component really isn't something that people talk about. It's like the lazy people that play. So it may be their own preconceptions that they're bringing in, saying, okay, you know, these are professors at the University of California. They're very accomplished. Look at what they've done. They must have sacrificed a lot. Plus, I think the media also kind of plays into that too.
Right, right. Well, and you know, the great thing is sort of alluded to this earlier. The great thing about an academic job is it's both its advantage and disadvantage, I will say, is you structure your own hours and you decide how much or how little you're going to do in any given day, right? Mm-hmm. And so I used to get up very, very early when I was younger, and I would send emails out at 4:30. And so everyone assumed I started my workday at 4 or 4:30 and I went straight through to 7, right, or something.
Or midnight.
Like that, or midnight even, right? Well, and what I realized after a while was what they were missing was I might start at 4 or 4:30, but by 8:30 I'm off running and having coffee with friends for a couple of hours, and then I'll go back to work. And then, you know, by 8 o'clock, 8:30 it used to be I was knocked out, you know? Uh-huh. And so there was this perception that I was going from 4:30 to – you know, 10 o'clock at night working the entire time. It's like, where did you get that? Of course not, you know? And I remember when I was first caught up by this, because I had three or four grad students come in to Pete's, and I was sitting there laughing with some friends having coffee and, you know, yucking it up. And they're like, oh, my God. We thought you worked all the time. And I was like, what are you, nuts? You know?
But see, there's the flip side to that. You asked about why they don't, you were mentioning about why they don't know that you're playing. And I'm sitting here thinking, boy, I feel badly, because I make great effort. I realized for the past 15 years to not let people know, including my graduate students, that I play, because I have had it turned again, turned it against me.
Right.
And in the same way that people think if they see an email from you at 4:12 in the morning that you're working the whole day, if they get the first one from me at 10 California time and they're on the East Coast, you get this thing about, well, banker's hours, but why haven't I heard back from you? And I think they just don't get it. And I guess it's just that's what – and to some degree that's what we have developed in as a society, right? We have sort of preconceived notions of what a typical work habit is. And so, I feel badly because I think I have spent a lot of my time hiding all of the freedoms that academic jobs give you. And I think we both enjoy life tremendously. And it helps that we have, great partners who allow us, afford us that opportunity. But, they do have a notion that we don't play, that we work all the time.
And that's interesting how you both handle it differently, where you really – and I understand that because as a woman, there have been a lot of times, you have too much on your plate. You have to go home and take care of the kids too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or I've been told women coaches can't – or women with families can't coach,
mm-hmm.
Because I work in a male-dominated area too, and I was just stunned that somebody would say that. I could see them believing that, but say that to somebody else. I do think I was always trying to cover things up to make sure that – I'm exceeding far beyond what you think. And look, I can start my day so much earlier than you because I'll be on the campus first.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe I have to get out of there earlier because I have to go pick up a kid.
Right.
But then I'll be back on the computer. I used to do this. It was crazy. I had a baby and I was back on the computer from 9 to midnight because I had to make sure that people knew
That's
I was
right.
still working.
Exactly. I mean, I think that aspect we do. And I think it's a mistake that we don't, share that more. And say, look, we're entitled to this. This is as long as we produce the product that, mm-hmm. that is expected. It's not your opinion, or it's not your judgment call as to whether it's good or bad. But I don't think we do that mm-hmm. enough. And I've had male colleagues who in the past have said, well, we would invite you to join us on this particular research project, but we realize you can't go away for 3 weeks at a time. And I have a spouse who. He's an enabler, as he calls himself. He enables me to go away, and he does enable me to go away for 4 to 6 weeks at a time. But they don't even give me the opportunity to say, well, ask me, and maybe I could.
Uh-huh.
And it's only because with the years I've bullied my way through and done it that I do it now. But there is this sense that maybe it's because that's what we expect of our spouse, and we say, well, then I expect that she also will be home at 3 or – or maybe that's what our mothers did and we think that that's normal. Who knows? But.
I also think that, starting off in academics, it's, there's nothing like your first year as a professor.
It is. Or first 4 years.
Yeah, maybe even your first, few years. It's really a lot of work. I mean, it doesn't matter who you are. It's a lot of work. Right. And it doesn't really even matter how ambitious you are. It's a lot of work. And I think you get in, for those of us who are – have ambitions beyond that, beyond just sort of getting settled in. I think it's easy to get on to this thing where you really do work a lot and then you sort of make it in whatever your definition of making it is. And then you forget to sort of take a step back and,
because you've been used to that.
Because
climb,
you've been used to working
so hard. And you just
so
continue.
Hard, right. And mm-hmm. you just adapt and then. Or else you take a step back, but you forget to tell everybody else that you've got to sort of taken a step back,
Right.
So everybody else thinks you're still working from 4 to midnight when in fact, you're not. So I think it's a combination of us too, because it is really hard when you first start out,
Right.
And it's easy to get caught up into that treadmill. And then when you stop, it's easy for people to assume
that it's still happening.
That it's still happening mm-hmm. for you, I've recently acquired a family with 3 kids, and I'm not sure I could have.
Soon a dog.
Yeah, and soon a dog.
and there's a record of that within the next 6 months.
So I'm not sure I could have had kids earlier in my career. That life balance thing has become very, much more visible to me than I think it was 3 years ago.
Yeah, it gets trickier with time.
It's completely.
And don't believe her for a second. Yeah. She could have balanced it.
No, it's true.
I think she could have.
But I think it's like with anything, you know, before you have kids, you think, oh, my gosh, I'm so busy. And then you have kids and you're like, what was I thinking? I mean, that was kind of cake, you know. And
right.
Because there was just time that for whatever reason, we just maybe frittered away. And now you just can't do that as much.
Right.
So, yeah, you probably could have done it just.
Well, I know she could have for various
all
reasons.
Those,
I know she
all
could
those
have.
Coffees at Pete's would have been like down the tubes.
She's a born nurturer. I know that firsthand. But you know, it's funny about the kids thing because we have a lot of colleagues who don't have kids. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody has – every professional in this country has lots of colleagues and friends who don't have kids. I mean that's clearly a trend, right, in Europe as well. And I would argue that it's the very fact that we have – families that give us perspective. I mean, I love what I do. There's no question about it. And I get a real rush from accomplishing. But the bottom line is when I get home, the reality is the family. You know, that puts me right back in place quickly on the day to day. And in the long term, I'm very aware of, you know, there's one legacy in life and that's what we produce out of them and where they go and they carry on. And so I would say that, you know, having the family is the best thing that people, professionals, can do to balance their life. Otherwise, they're by definition imbalanced because they lose perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting because I was telling Iz and a couple of friends on a run that, you know, my job has always been a priority for me, always. And in the last year or so, it's interesting. It's still important, but it's not the top priority. And that has created a shift in me about what I'm willing to battle about what I take home, about how stressed out I get at night over what has to be done, about even about how clean the bathroom is. You know,
never noticed that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just in your house.
It's just amazing. It's been this major awakening about what was important. And I always saw it in them running. But it was to actually have it happen to me at, you know, sort of in my midlife was just remarkable. It was just remarkable, you know.
One thing that you mentioned earlier was about that you have a lot of freedom as academics about your work, how, you know, the time structure of how you work. And you're even seeing this happen now in corporate America, or women are now starting their own businesses because they don't want to work those so-called traditional hours. And I know for years I struggled because I always said, well, I don't work 8 to 5, so I don't work that hard. But I was working all throughout the day, you know, and all throughout the evening and 7 days a week. But I thought, well, I didn't work 8 to 5. And so I couldn't be working that hard because I had this, like, random schedule, you know, just to make everything work. And now I realize I'm just not an 8 to 5 person. But and there's time periods where I'm very effective, and then there's time periods that I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
So do you see like that being an issue, like an 8 to 5, or I know some.
You know, I was telling them on a run. I sat in a 2-day meeting in Sacramento, and the meeting started at 8, and it went to 5:30. And when I came home, I said, I could never work an 8 to 5 job anymore. You know, there's no way I could do it. I mean, the being able to parcel parts of my day out for different things it's just part of who I am now.
Yeah. I always wonder if academia kind of filters people out anyway. There's certain types that go towards that, and maybe in part that's those of us who can't deal with a 9 to 5. But yeah, I agree. I could never imagine walking into an office and being told to be quote-unquote creative over these hours or team play over these hours. That just isn't going to happen. And but then maybe that's because we filter ourselves out to the right professions, or maybe we've learned to become this way.
Right.
I don't know. But I got to tell you, I go to work so that I can escape the – I think what people who don't leave the house and work with what I see them doing, you know. I mean, it's overwhelming to me. I actually find my solace sometimes in my office because I – only have to do one thing, and that's the one thing I put in front of me on the table. And
oh, no, there are many days I'm like, oh, I just need to get to work. I need to go. I need to get out of the house because it can be a lot harder to be at home. A lot harder, and you just feel like you're schlepping around and you're the servant, I was this morning because my kids could not get breakfast for themselves. They were very upset about that. Now, Mentors. We talked about mentors. Now, did you have mentors?
Yeah. No, actually, you know, I don't have any mentor. Well, I mean, I would say my advisor, you know, in grad school, I'm very close to, and he's been very helpful through the years. In terms of women who were mentors, I would say I don't have any engineering women mentors to speak of. I have friends, but who also provide advice. But mentors in terms of people who are sort of helping you along with your career with advantageous sort of, you know, efforts on their part, no. And I there's one woman in biology who through the years has been – who has been really good to me, but not in engineering. It's – you know, I it's pretty hard to have female mentors in engineering because there's just not enough of us. And sort of my generation is the generation coming into being, so we're sort of more the mentors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think it's yeah. I read your questions yesterday, and I was amused because yesterday I had one of my male colleagues come in, and I was actually shocked by this. He came in to essentially to talk about the sort of dynamics in the department, but his main point to me was that I was not doing enough of a job as a mentor, and I was appalled at first that, you know, how dare he? What is he saying? And then I realized, oh my gosh, you know, I'm not a mentor. I never would even have thought to go to our 7 assistant professors and asked if they wanted to be mentored. I wouldn't even know how to approach them. Because I didn't have mentors. And I think that's a thing that we're hearing this term and this phrase, mentoring. That's something very new. And we, by definition, probably didn't because, one, there weren't that many women. And I know in my experience, the women I had who were more senior to me, who I had interactions with, I shied away because I got nothing but insulted for having chosen to have children, for instance. Mm-hmm. It was not an option. They weren't mentors. If anything, I ran the other way.
I think there was a stigma on women in that sense, not helping other women because it was like they had to sacrifice so much to get to where they were. Mm-hmm. And now things are changing, you know, slowly. That where women can have some sort of balance or mm-hmm. have kids at some point. It may not all happen at one time, but, you know, that it's kind of a marathon and it can happen in different stages.
It's funny that this retreat in Houston I was at, there was a talk given by a psychologist who's doing a lot of studies, a lot of research into mentoring, and she called it the Queen Bee Syndrome. And there's research to sort of support these women who gave up a huge amount and then have very little empathy or willingness to sort of help the next generation along.
Especially if they're having kids and gut.
Right, and especially if they're making choices that were different from their own.
That's right.
Even in my own field with just men, I mean, a lot of times they'll say, oh, well, you know, I had to, you know, do this and it was so much harder for me. And I have the philosophy of, you know, we stand on the shoulders of those that came before us. But there are those out there that have the philosophy, if I walk through 6 miles of snow, you have to at least do that, if not more, because what I did was so hard and you have to make it hard. And I don't see that as progress because if everybody keeps going back to where they were, you're not going to really advance that much further versus if everybody can kind of learn from each other and stand on each other's shoulders, there can be more advancement made.
Right.
You know, so.
Well, it was really interesting at this. Again, I keep going to this Rice workshop just because I just came from, and it was a room full of women in engineering and science. And there was a question put out to the group that by a speaker who said, you know, do you believe it's your obligation/responsibility to help the next generation of women faculty succeed in their careers? And it was very interesting because I'd say probably about half the room really resisted this notion that they had any obligation or responsibility to the next generation. And then there was another half of the room, sort of my level, that were saying, of course you have an obligation. It's a moral obligation to help the next generation. And finally, one young assistant professor said to the other side, she said, how would you respond if it were climate change, right? And so then there was this whole discussion about how you parse what you have an obligation or responsibility for the next generation versus what you don't.
Right.
You know, so I think even today women are divided. You know, they have complicated feelings about what they need to do to help the next generation of women faculty. And there are some who say, of course, we have this social and moral obligation to help them succeed. And there are others who say, you know, even now, it's their job to succeed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Isabel, when you had mentioned one of your colleagues coming in and saying you're not doing enough to mentor, I was really surprised because I've never looked at it where a mentor would come down and say, hey, do you need to be mentored? I've always seen it as someone who was looking for mentors, looking, kind of going, okay, this is kind of where I want to go, or this person has information that can be useful to me, and going and asking. I mean, that's pretty much what I've done throughout my mm-hmm. career, is finding those people. And more often than not, I think I've gotten the help. But I've never thought of it from the other side where somebody...
Right. Well, it's funny because I actually think this brings this kind of conversation a little bit full circle, in the sense that my interpretation of this colleague's visit was that my door is closed too often. I am working non-traditional hours very much so right now, and it's a choice. I sequester myself at home. I do my writing at home. I choose to go home in the afternoons a few days a week to spend time with kids. Sometimes I'm working, and they have friends over, and sometimes I'm actually doing something with them. But I work very non-traditional hours, very late, sometimes very early, and some days long, some days short. But in his eyes, it just didn't fit the mold, right, that he anticipated. So I actually think it was an effort to let me know that there we go, back to this, you know, you're not working those full hours. What are you doing? And I can only imagine if I went, turned the tables and said, here's my CV and here's yours, and you don't seem to be working hard enough in comparison to what I'm accomplishing. I would love to know what his reaction would be to that, you know, but mm-hmm. That's not the point. I think maybe he did feel that I could be more of a mentor, but I think it was in the context of, you know, you're not around enough to be the mentor.
I had a dean say to me once that he wanted me there from 7 in the morning till 7 at night, and I would come in at 6, and he would never even come in until 9:30. And, you know, and then I look around at some of the other faculty, and you know, one, he comes in and he goes on his personal email. He brings the paper to work, mm-hmm. you know, and we're PE faculty, so, you know, there's that issue. But I'm like, bring the paper to work? You know, when I come, I sit down and I'm just like blowing through things, you know, and if I have students that I need to work with or athletes that I need to work with, that I come and I'm there for my job.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll figure out when I can read the paper, if I can read the paper. I consider that a luxury item for myself, mm-hmm. not something that I would do in a work environment. But yeah, no, he was very adamant that, you know, I needed to be there from 7 in the morning till 7 at night. And I thought it didn't matter what I produced. It mattered that I was in that office during those times. Mm-hmm. So if I wanted to, you know, read the paper, surf the internet, do all these other things, talk on the phone to tons of other people, that was fine, mm-hmm. as long as I was there those hours.
That's so true. I mean, but many of us were raised by mentors, quote unquote, our advisors, mm-hmm. Or those other faculty where we were, that's right. I want you to be the philosophy being, I want you to be there all the hours that I'm there. I want to see you there when I get there in the morning and when I leave in the evening, you know. Yeah.
Well, one thing, and I do think it's even changing out in the other work world, is that, you know, people are realizing, and some people are different. Some people I know professors that do work a very traditional schedule. They like that. They, you know, because some people look at me and go, I can't believe your crazy schedule. But the other thing is that I realize for me, there are times that I am prime. Like, I can just get things done, and I can be so much more effective and efficient in maybe that 4-hour time period or 2-hour time period, then if I try to do it like in a more traditional sense of an 8-to-5, I just wouldn't get as much done. I wouldn't be effective.
Right.
So for me, I just know that that's what works. And maybe as I'm getting older, I'm getting more in tune with that and knowing that. I don't know.
But I think that comes back to what you originally asked us, you know, in that are there differences? And I don't think it's a gender thing specifically, but I think it's maybe a generational thing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our male colleagues are older. And it's starting to change, just turning over. But that is a basis of – or you know, a function of there not being as many women, and they're younger women. And so they maybe have this stereotypical view of the 9-to-5 mentality. And maybe that is changing. But that all comes into play then with if we're not fitting into that role, that stereotype, then, you know, we're messing with their vision of what's right and wrong.
Well, I don't think they can see it, because, like, in my situation, when I was talked to by my dean and another colleague, and they were very concerned, because how could I do my job mm-hmm. when I had 4 kids and I had a husband who was a coach, because they have very demanding jobs and their wives don't work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go.
And they just couldn't see that. And my thing was, they don't understand that I don't even know how to cook. So I don't cook. You know, like, we have our own issues, and there's balance, and, you know, we struggle, like, who's going to take more precedent that day and who's going to do what. So we have those issues. It's not just clean cut. But it has changed, but I don't think for them, this is what they were raised, and this is what they do. And I think it's going to be the newer, younger generations who are – that have the dual careers, mm-hmm. you know, right. and that are realizing, okay, we have to balance. You know, maybe somebody goes a four-year period where it's much more, you know, profession-dominated, mm-hmm. and then you switch. I mean, I know people right. that do right. that.
I think a lot of them, sadly enough, are just not having kids. That's what it seems to yeah. – at least I see that in genealogy, and hopefully that's not a – it's not really a trend, but it seems to be.
That happens a lot. You're listening to How She Really Does It on Catered LP 101.5 FM, and we're talking with UC Davis Science Professors Deb Niemeyer and Isabel Montanez. And so were you guys always interested in science and math?
No. In fact, I was on my way to become something else, you know, to become a teacher or something. And I was actually I was taking a drive down with a then boyfriend who was going to go to UT Austin and become an electrical engineer. And in the seat of – I mean, on the floor of his car was the College of Engineering catalog. And I picked that up, and I was flipping through it. And he said to me, you know, girls can't become engineers. So I flipped through and I found –
the guy you married?
Yeah. I flipped through and I found the degree that looked like you were outside the most, and I went and changed my major the day we arrived on campus. I mean, it's been great since then, but no, that was a bit of a diversion from where I thought I was heading at the time.
So it's kind of the challenge of it all.
Yeah.
And what about you, Isabel?
I mean, I didn't want to be a geologist. I wanted to be a paleontologist. I think a lot of kids want to be paleontologists, but I stuck with that. I don't even know why, frankly, I wanted to be that. But I stuck with the idea that I'd have to get a geology degree to do it, and I actually didn't particularly like getting the geology degree for all the reasons we talked about earlier. I somehow thought I wasn't as talented in math, and my teachers were – my professors were happy to sort of indulge me with that fantasy as well. And I knew I would be a scientist. I mean, I think ultimately I have that in me.
When you were talking about how did you get through it and get your degree when you didn't really like it? You didn't think that you could do it. So how did you overcome that? What were the things that you did?
Well, I shouldn't say I didn't like my degree. I guess I didn't like – I went to an all-women's college, which is the irony of the whole thing, you know. and I didn't fit the traditional mold. You know, I hung out with non-geologists. I dressed like a not like a scientist. I didn't hang out weekends and evenings in the coffee room of the students in wearing my hiking boots, even though we weren't going in the field for a month, you know. I just didn't play those games. And so – it was a small faculty of four or five, and I just didn't fill the role, and they were happy to treat me as I didn't.
Okay.
And I think, you know, I did okay in places, but ultimately in geology it's a lot of field work, and every summer I would go out west, and I was sure I loved that. So that kept me going. But in terms of the – I didn't think I was good at it. I didn't think I was good at it until I finally realized one day, wow, I got tenure. Wow, I'm a full professor. I guess I'm okay at this. You know, I think that's one of those things. I just wasn't raised in an environment that told me I was good at things very often.
You know, I wonder if that's just a kind of a female-male thing, because as I've coached – and I've coached little kids all the way through college – and one of the things that I notice, and like you'll see a little boy might watch something on TV and he'll jump off a couch because he thinks he can fly. And for a moment, a very quick moment, he does. Mm-hmm. And a girl will look at that and go, that's just can't happen. That's right. Not practical. Mm-hmm. I'm not even going to try it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if some of that, I don't know if it's just how we are just genetically made or if there's part of the social structure that kind of, because when I deal with women and male athletes, those are the two issues. Like the men are like, oh, yeah. I can be a state champ or I can be an NCAA champ. And the women, there's a lot more work to get them there because a lot of times they stop themselves from believing it.
Right.
And so it's about, you know, those – I think the ones that can believe it actually are the ones that can go a lot further regardless of the talent that they have.
Right. Well, this is, I'm thinking back at that comment I made where men are entitled to an ego and women have to define it. And they have to, yeah. And so I think it comes back to that. You know, I can't tell you why I didn't think I was doing good well enough or why I thought maybe I was struggling when, in fact, if I look back, I wasn't. It's my own demons, but I think it's my own female demons.
Okay. Let's see. What else do we have here? What would you recommend for young women who are interested in pursuing a career in science?
if people could only see who's pointing at me. Oh, goodness. I just think that one has to first pursue their dreams and their what they wish. But, I'm sort of lost for words of that, except that if I could do something all over again, it would be to have a thicker skin earlier. And that has a lot of different definitions. But I think that if one can learn to as women, we're always asking ourselves, you know, whether it's our fault or whether we could have done something differently. We're always revisiting every situation, good and bad. And I think that makes us wonderful beings. But it's baggage. It's mm-hmm. And I think if you're going to pursue a field that is one professional, two male dominated, and you're going to try to balance your life, whatever that involves, then you really have to work at not just seeing the trees of guilt and hurt and things like that, and sort of step back, learn to find a way to be able to step back and see things from the bigger picture, and that helps you make that tougher skin. And I think then you can work through all the other issues.
And I think at a younger level, even for daughters and kids, girls growing up, I think about, we just did science projects at the elementary school, mm-hmm. and I have a fourth grader, two fourth graders, and one of them was very reluctant to do anything that was sort of edgy on this science project, and yet she was completely capable of it. And so, I spent some time really pushing her a lot harder than she, to go to further than she was really prepared to do, and she ended up doing this big taste test between bottled water and Davis tap water. And she surveyed, 30 people and had them do blind taste tests. But at the beginning, she was going to do something simple, like why do eggs sink to the bottom of the glass or whatever. And, once she got started on it, boy, you could just see her confidence just going up. And, she would walk up to people that she had never met before and say, will you do my water test, and write down the result. And so I think if I were going to say something to parents, I'd tell them, push your kids, put them on the edge. It's going to be the edge of what you're comfortable too, mm-hmm. probably with, but push them, push them to take science one step further at every juncture in the road.
That's right. Yeah, that's very, 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 very true.
Well, and I think in the home front, it does make a big difference. Having you guys as scientists and raising children, that's going to the children will know more about what possibilities there are out there. Mm-hmm. And so they will just – that will be more of a natural flow.
But it's our message versus a much bigger message
in the outside world.
You're not really good at this. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I could see it in my daughter's sort of – the way she approached the problem is that – she's getting a bigger message that sort of one person is trying to counteract. And so I think you have to be really diligent. You can't mm-hmm. you can't let it go, because they're getting pressed. They're getting a much bigger mm-hmm. much bigger message.
That's so true. It's so true. But the one thing that I was really pleased on, I had left your questions that you'd sent on the table, and yesterday my older son picked it up. And even though I often see these other messages they get from the outside, dad makes more money than you, or dad's the boss. And I think, oh my goodness, where is this coming from? It's not coming from in the house. He picked up your questions and he was looking at them sincerely. And he said, to the ones about the dress code differences, the difference between the gender differences in the work world, he said, duh, I mean, what does this mean? Meaning he doesn't recognize that there is any gender difference. And so I actually was really pleased in the sense that, okay, something's changing around here. Something is changing.
Well, I do think that it is changing. Yeah. You know, the kids are growing up in a somewhat different environment. And so, you know, that Leave It to Beaver role is, you know, slowly leaving, depending on where you are.
I think it's going to take a couple generations. And
but it's like anything else. You know, it's very easy to assume progress will continue unaided once it's started. And that's not always true. It's easy to slide backward and then have to start all over again going. You know, I mean, you think of it, it's much easier to go down a hill than it is to go up a hill. So when you go up a hill, the you know, as you're traveling up a hill, the momentum is really to push you back down. It's not to not to bring you up the hill. So it's it requires constant diligence and sort of being attentive.
And I think that people think, oh, the progress is being made. And so then, okay, we're going to go do something else. And then that's when things go back down.
Right.
And we're seeing some of that stuff happen just, you know, in the national media too.
Right.
But, yeah, to just to be constantly pushing and seeing what can happen. Well, ladies, thank you so much for coming.
And,
you know, thank you for being women in science and being role models for other women out there and also for men to see that women can do science too. We've had professors Deb Niemeyer and Isabel Montanez here talking to us about women in science. And thanks for listening to How She Really Does It with Corinne at KDRT LP 101.5 FM. You can catch the replays on